accession number 17993, Reel 1.
Squadron leader Schweiger, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Leamington Spa in Warwickshire.
Which year was this?
1930, 24th of June 1930.
You were telling me that you have some Hungarian ancestry.
Yes, my grandfather came to England at the turn of the century, worked principally in India and in London as a world-renowned Indian art expert. And my father was, though born in India in Calcutta, was educated in England, as indeed was I.
Whereabouts in England did you go to school?
Cheltenham College.
And how old were you when you left there?
18.
And that was after the war had ended, of course.
Yeah, that is so.
Do you have any Second World War memories, or maybe of German bombing or anything of that kind?
Yes, I do, actually, because I was at prep school in the Cotswolds. The school actually had been evacuated from Maidstone in Kent. And apart from myself, the initial 10 or 12 of us at the school all came from Kent, places like Offham and Ottam, and they all came back with reminiscences of the Battle of Britain and bits of aircraft and souvenirs and things like that. And also I do remember the night of the Coventry raid, because even though we were a good way away from Coventry, the sky was lit up and you could hear the explosions and so on. But other than that, we had a fairly quiet time in the Cotswolds.
Was the evacuation to the Cotswolds a success?
Yes, we had a delightful Elizabethan manor house in a small village near Broadway in Worcestershire, and it was the most wonderful place to be, and a very small school. It gradually increased in size over time. Very happy and lovely time, yes.
But no bombs actually fell near you?
I think we had some incendiaries on the Gordon Russell furniture factory at Broadway, which in fact during the war used to make the wooden silhouette model aircraft for aircraft recognition purposes, and there was a minor fire, but that was about all. The principal problem was the large number of training airfields in the Vale of Evesham, where there were unfortunately a very large number of crashes, the Cotswolds being about 1,000 feet, 1,200 feet high. Some of them never made it over the top, unfortunately. But my prep school headmaster, Crofton Cooper, was also the driver and chief of the village fire brigade, which consisted of an old motor car and a trailer pump. And whenever the siren went off, he used to hightail it into his fire engine, if we can call it that. And we left our classroom, and where we saw the great column of black smoke, we went across country and normally got there first. But we did have an unfortunate number of serious accidents. Whitley's, Stirling's, Hamden's, that sort of thing.
What was the name of the prep school?
Hill Place.
And where was it located?
Willersey, which is near Broadway in Worcestershire.
Now, how did you come to be in the RAF yourself, please?
I always wanted to be a pilot. Now, that sounds a bit stupid remark, but from the age of about 8, when I first started doing a paper round, I used to buy model aeroplane kits. I just was interested. I had no background in the RAF at all, even though I did have an uncle in the RAF during the war, but that was I became interested before that. And anyway, he was in an administrative capacity at the Air Ministry. So, I don't know, it just happened. I was so determined.
How and when did you go about it?
I went up the science route at Cheltenham, and in the upper six there was an option for a cadetship at Cranwell, which I went for, passed the relative interviews and so on, and became a cadet at Cranwell in January 1949.
How long was the course at Cranwell?
It was 2.5 years then.
What did you think of it?
It was very good. It was quite demanding. The initial period was quite heavy physically, in that one had to live the theoretical, at any rate, I think, life of the ideal airman. and we had to do all the training, assault course work, use of weapons, Sten gun, Bren gun, rifle, pistol, and all that sort of thing. A lot of sport, but it was demanding. They're very good fun. But after the first 6 months, which was that period in which you were the very lowest of the low in the Air Force, you became a flight cadet, which is a slightly higher rank, and you had a use of batting services, for example, and lived quite well in the college with formal dining in nights and that sort of thing. So that was jolly good fun, and many, many opportunities for all sorts of activities. If you had an idea and you could find another three or four flight cadets who thought it was a good idea for doing something like climbing Everest or starting a music society, provided you made a case for it, the funds, which I think most came from the prize fund, you could start it. I, for example, used to ride, I used to glide, music society, and that sort of thing. So it was a very, it was rather like perhaps a slightly more formalised university course.
Did you get much of what the army calls bull there?
The first 6 months, yes, but thereafter not so much. Though drill and parades were an important part, because it was felt that the discipline of working as a team and doing everything together and obeying orders and that sort of thing would be good educationally, and I'm sure that's quite correct.
Were there any outstanding personalities at Cranwell with whom you came in contact?
Yes, indeed. My first commandant was Air Marshal George Beamish, who was the Irish international rugby player, as indeed were his two brothers, both in the RAF too. And the second one was Air Marshal Sinclair, Laurie Sinclair, who had rescued a crew from a burning aircraft during the war and was awarded the George Cross for that. He was a very interesting personality. And the instructors, I'm sure were hand-picked, so the very best flying instructors, ground instructors, used to teach us what we were supposed to know and learn.
So when did your course at Cranwell finish?
In August 1951.
And what were you ready for and capable of doing by then?
Well, I'd like to say a little bit about the graduation. The graduation was, the reviewing officer was Her Royal Highness Princess Elizabeth, now the Queen, of course, and it was a great occasion. And I wanted to go into fighters, jet fighters, which is indeed where I was posted.
Where to exactly?
I went to number 2 Advanced Flying School at Middleton St George in County Durham to convert onto the Meteor.
What was it like flying the Meteor?
Well, it's a big step up from the Harvard. Indeed.
Did it have any problems in handling?
It was not an easy aeroplane on one engine. And in those days, it was normal practice to actually stop an engine when you practice asymmetric flying. And therefore, you had no escape route if something went wrong or you didn't get it quite right. And after a number of accidents, policy was changed in that you just closed the throttle, you didn't actually stop the engine, which is a very sensible move. But it was actually a press campaign, I think, highlighting the number of fatal accidents, which caused that policy to be introduced.
Was being a fighter pilot in 1951 very much the same as it had been during the Second World War, do you think?
The objective, I think, of the air staff at the time was to keep the same sort of spirit. In that respect, yes, I think you're right.
And so you arrived there in August 51, presumably?
Yes, I went, and then after Middleton, after converted on the Meteor 4, I went to number 226 Operational Conversion Unit at Stradishall in Suffolk, where I then was taught the practicalities of fighter, that is, air-to-air firing, air-to-ground firing. And then I did a further course on fighter reconnaissance, which covered the taking of low-level photographs, either forward-facing or oblique photographs, and low-flying training.
What were the lessons which they tried to impress on you at Stradish Hall particularly?
Well, Stradish Hall, of course, was the business of how to use the gyro gun sight and how to use your guns and how to shoot down the enemy, how to hit a target air to ground without actually hitting the ground yourself, which unfortunately quite a few people used to do from time to time. And the photographic thing was a matter of being at the right height to the right speed in order to get photographs of a quality that could be used for reconnaissance purposes by the army, particularly. A very good course.
But what was the method of approach in those days which was promoted for approaching an enemy aircraft which you wanted to shoot down?
Well, we of course had radar, and the radar by that time was somewhat more sophisticated than it had been in earlier days in the last war. And there was a technique of you being scrambled and vectored onto an enemy formation, which was probably some of your colleagues or maybe some of bomber command, and then you went ahead and did the attack and took photographs with your cine gun camera, and came back and said, you know, what a heroic chap I am, having not fired a shot at all, of course.
And after Stradish Hall?
Stradish Hall, I was posted to 208 Squadron in Egypt, Abu Swer in Egypt.
What date have we reached now?
I was fortunate. I went out on a troop ship, a 2 weeks voyage courtesy of the Royal Air Force, on the troop ship Lancashire, which took 2 weeks with just one stop at Malta, and to then travel by bus, I think, down to RAF Abu Swer, which was on the road between Ismailia and Cairo, and they were equipped with the Meteor Fighter Reconnaissance Mark 9 aircraft, and they had a wide-ranging operational role both as air defence fighters as well as reconnaissance.
Meteor Mark 9?
Mark 9, yes, FR-9.
Was that much different from the Mark 4?
It was very similar to the Mark 8. The Mark 4 was the one of the earlier operational ones. The Mark 8 was had significant improvements, and the FR-9, the main difference was the presence of cameras in the nose.
What dates were you with 208 at Abu Swer?
I got there in April 1952, which you as a historian will, I'm sure, remember was the time when we were having a little bit of difficulty with the Egyptians. And one of our roles was to daily recce the Egyptian army, because the British had said that if the Egyptian army advanced beyond a certain point outside Cairo, then there would be retaliatory action, so we had to go and check that the Egyptian armour or tanks or whatever hadn't moved, and they never did.
Did you actually photograph them?
Oh yes, took pictures of where they were. I think it was General Erskine who decreed or promoted this policy, and I think the line at which they were not supposed to cross was called the Erskine line, but I could be corrected on that one.
What were living conditions like for you in Egypt?
We were extremely lucky. Abu Swer was a permanent station with all facilities, proper buildings. It got a little difficult because all the Arab staff walked out after a while. We were then confined to the camp behind the barbed wire, essentially, for about 6 months. But we had our own facilities and we lived reasonably well. But it was a bit irksome being behind the wire, you know, for that time. But on the other hand, since we had our fighter aeroplanes, we were able to get across, for example, to Cyprus, where we used to go for armament practice camp, air-to-air shooting.
Was the Arab walkout a political walkout?
Well, it's all to do with the... Yes, okay, political is a good summary of it, yes. They used to shoot at us a bit, but... it was all right if you ducked.
Were there any casualties or any damage done?
Yes, they had this rather charming habit of stringing wires between two trees on a road, and if you drove your 1500 weight truck or whatever it was with the windscreen down, or even with it up, you would collect that and decapitate it. And there were one or two incidents like that. I think a busload of school children was attacked on one occasion. But since we weren't permitted to go out, it didn't really affect us.
Busload of British school children?
I believe so, yes. Yes.
Did you feel yourself to be in much danger there?
Not really, no. We had a full perimeter of wire with floodlights and armed sentries, and I felt, well, youth never feels much afraid, I don't think. After about 6 months, we were permitted to leave the camp in certain. It was to go to Ismailia, for example, which was quite a thriving headquarters of the Suez Canal Company, with a population of, apart from Arabs, of Greeks, Italians, French, British. A lot of the pilots, Canal Company pilots, lived there. But we had to have two vehicles and four people, all armed. By that time I'd managed to acquire an MG sports car, and a colleague of mine on the squadron also had one, so we used to go out in those, and since they're very low to the ground, we reckon we could get under any wire if it was strung across the road. So I must admit we never came across any.
And what was your next move?
We went to Iraq, Habania, for an exercise, I remember. Habania was very famous RAF station. It again was a very permanent station, even better than Abu Suair, with every facility. It had even its own polo ground and race course, its own pack of jackal hounds, churches, cinemas, wonderful place. And we went there for an exercise with the resident squadrons, number 6 squadron, number 73, I think, were based there.
This was the whole of your squadron?
Yes. I was then, by then, in the squadron formation aerobatic team, and we put on a show for the Iraqi army, which we used to do shows every now and then for people.
So this was just a brief visit, you mean?
Yes, yeah.
What do you remember next, please?
Then we went, I'm not too sure this is in the right sequence, but we went to the airfield El Adam, which is south of Tobruk, because we had a task to photograph the whole of the coastline of Crete for NATO. And we had a detachment of 4 aircraft, which I commanded, because by that time I was the photographic interpretations officer. I'd done a course on photographic interpretation, and we had to photograph the whole coastline within a certain scale, which meant a certain distance away from the coast and a certain height. And this became somewhat difficult in that there were little bits where you couldn't get because the ground was too high. However, we did accomplish the task. I think it took about 6 weeks, something like that.
Did you know what the idea of that was?
No.
Are we still in 1952 now?
Yes. After that, we had a detachment at Sharjah in the Persian Gulf, which is now, of course, an oil-rich place, but then was a sand strip with a slick of oil down the middle to stabilize it, and we operated out of there, and we had two roles there. One was to look for slaving vessels, would you believe? And the other was to go south into the desert to the camel trails, because it was felt that the Saudis were infiltrating along the camel trails to the south with the prospect of finding oil at a place called Buraimi. But Sharjah was a pretty primitive place then, a medieval Arab fort and not much else. But each day, first thing in the morning, we did a first light recce all the way up the coast to Bahrain. Spent the day by the swimming pool in Bahrain, watching the comet come through on its way out to the Far East.
Do you think you had any success in the anti-slaving operations?
I don't know. I don't think anybody saw any. We all had visions of lots of slaves in boats with oars being forced and whipped up the Persian Gulf, but we didn't actually see anybody. We did have a third role, as just remembered, and that was there was a small island which I think the sole inhabitant, or one of a very few inhabitants, was an Englishman who was mining something or another. Could it be ochre? At any rate, it was a little island in between the Gulf and in the middle of the Gulf. And one of the things we had to do before we went on our journey up to Bahrain was to fly over his island, and if the Union Jack was flying, he was all right. If it wasn't, he wasn't all right. But there again, it was always flying.
And the watch on Saudi intentions regarding the Baremia Oasis, what did that amount to?
There again, we never actually saw anything of any significance. We did have a report of an intelligence report of some Saudi military of some sort coming down the camel trail well to the south. So a couple of airplanes rushed off there and had a look, didn't find anything. And then we then had an apology, which seemed to come from the Iraqi military, from the Saudi military, via the Trucial Oman levies, to apologise that we'd wasted our time looking for something that wasn't there. So it was all rather bizarre. The Baremi, I think, has been developed as a significant oil-producing area.
What happened next?
excuse me. About this time, a signal came to the squadron asking for volunteers to go and reinforce the Royal Australian Air Force Squadron number 77 in Korea. They had been in Korea since the very beginning of the Korean War, 1950, and they had lost a number of pilots through accidents or being shot down by enemy aircraft, and many of them had done two or three operational tours in Korea, and they needed reinforcements. So the signal arrived, and myself and a friend, good friend of mine who had been at Cranwell with me, we both volunteered, and I was selected. But I was the second person from the squadron to go, because a good friend of mine also at Cranwell with me, Taffy Rosser, had gone out a few months earlier, but sadly was shot down almost as soon as he got there by anti-aircraft fire and was killed. So I volunteered and waited to see if I was selected, and indeed I was. So then I got all my sort of movement orders and set off in May 1953, and I flew by Valletta via Mafraq in Jordan to Habania in Iraq, where I transferred to Hastings. And at that point I met up with Keith Williamson, who had again been at Cranwell with me, who finished up as Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Sir Keith Williamson, Chief of the Air Staff, with Alistair Christie, another Cranwellian, who retired as Group Captain A.M. Christie, and a Flight Lieutenant Pat Mullen. I regret, I don't know what happened to him. And the four of us then went via Moripur in Pakistan, Negombo, Ceylon, or Sri Lanka, Changi, Singapore, Clark Field in the Philippines, and to Iwakuni in southern Honshu, Japan. We then reported to the Australian Air Force headquarters for a conversion course into firing rockets, because this is the role of 77 Squadron. We had not, most of us hadn't any experience of rocket firing, so that was the objective of the course in Japan. Iwakuni Air Base was in fact a Japanese naval base, and it was said that the kamikaze pilots, or some of them at any rate, were trained there. There was indeed, in front of the officer's mess, a Shinto shrine with names on it and dates, we were told, which indicated those kamikazes of violence who had gone out and didn't return from their operations. The mess was run by the Australians, and there was an Australian group captain in charge of their rear base there, but the base itself was actually operated by the United States. And they had its main purpose was for maintenance of aircraft and for communications transport. After about 10 days or so, we had done our training on rocket firing and so on, a briefing about the area and what we were supposed to do, and we set off, the four of us, to Kimpo, K-14, in South Korea. This Kimpo is near Seoul and is now in fact the international airport for Seoul, and it was about 11 miles behind the front line, where of course there was a shooting war going on, albeit by this time in 1953 peace negotiations had been going on for some time. Nevertheless, there was still a fair amount of fighting going on. After
excuse me, what does K-14 mean?
All the airfields in Korea, some of them, because presumably they had rather difficult names, were called K something or another, and indeed similarly in Japan the airfields were J something, or J and a number, or K and a number. I don't think it's American practice, it may well be for foreign airfields. Anyway, after a couple of trips sort of getting to know the local area, going across the bomb line to have a look at the north and find out salient navigation points, because it was all done by map reading, of course, no sophisticated navigation equipment. We then were put on operations and carried out a number of strikes on North Korea with high explosive rockets or napalm rockets. The napalm rockets were developed by the Australians, which were essentially this jellified petroleum in about 5-gallon canisters, and they were extremely effective in destroying the targets we attacked. We used to fly 16 aircraft, attack one target. Targets, generally speaking, were described as troop concentrations by the American intelligence, and we utterly and completely destroyed a village with 16 airplanes firing these napalm rockets. Somewhere around about the end of July, or the last week or so of July, the peace was eventually signed. The war was actually prolonged a little while because Syngman Rhee, the president of South Korea, had released some North Korean prisoners, which seemed to upset everybody, and so the thing went on for a little bit longer. But the peace was signed, or at least a truce was signed, and we then reverted to much more defensive role in the squadron. We didn't go across the bomb line at all. We just kept up training and vigilance and standbys and that sort of thing for the period of our detachment, which was 6 months. In fact, this was slightly extended to 7 months. Fairly boring time, this, because we were cut down in the amount of flying we did, and there wasn't terribly much to do.